Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. Happy to be back from vacation. Happy to start the year with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Welcome. How are you? Missed ya.
Good morning and Happy New Year.
Good to have you. How was your holiday?
Well, I actually was under the weather, shall we say, but that was okay because I think the country was under the weather throughout most of 2017, so it's kind of only fair.
Ken, we've got big news here. As you know, Senator Franken leaves the Senate today, knowing that there are a number of his colleagues who don't think he should leave, and a group of colleagues led by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand who think he really had no other choice. Tell me how you're at this point assessing the larger, I don't know, political lesson or fallout from this.
It's one, and we've said this, we've talked about this on your show for a long time. It's one, clearly, one of the biggest political stories of the year. And it's interesting, the year started off with the women's movement in Washington as a counter-protest to President Trump's inauguration. But this Me Too movement that basically started off with a response to Harvey Weinstein and what's going on in corporate world, which spread to the entertainment field and the media field and now politics. It just seems to be, as Gillibrand will be the first to tell you, a zero tolerance of the way men treat women. Now, to say did Al Franken treat women the way Roy Moore did or President Trump is alleged to have done, that may not be the case, but that may not be the point either. As we've said on your show, I think there's a sea change going on between the way men have treated women, and we're seeing it clearly in politics.
Ken, do you think the fact that Roy Moore did not win gives more, I don't want to say credibility, but more political force to Senator Gillibrand's and the people who believe Franken had to leave, more force to that?
Well, except that Roy Moore was such an outlier in the fact that he did things. I mean, the thought we're talking about here, accusations of sexual activity with 14-year-old girls, which is beyond the pale, that he was barred from shopping malls because he was out scouting, looking around for young women. It was beyond belief. But politically, how much did he suffer? I mean, he didn't lose a job. He was running for a Senate seat that he only barely lost.
Well,
lost by like 20.
But let me explain why I'm asking it the way I'm asking it. I was asking you that because there were people saying, well, look at Roy Moore. He's going to get elected. I thought he was going to get elected. He's going to get elected. Why should Al Franken have to leave the Senate if he's going to be part of the Senate? Well, he didn't get elected. I wonder if that changes the argument a bit for these people who were like, you know, look at this. Look at the injustice of this.
Well, yes. I mean, and we've said this on your show, and I've heard other guests on your show talk about this as well, that Al Franken was always, unlike Roy Moore, Al Franken was an advocate for women's rights, as Bill Clinton was when he was running for president the first time in 91 and 92. And yet, according to Gillibrand and others who now have second thoughts about this, that Bill Clinton also had activities and behavior issues that were not addressed at the time. So, look, things have been going on for a long, long time, the way, you know, the harassment and worse, and it was time to stop. Now, of course, had Roy Moore won, then people say, well, why are the Democrats paying the price? Why are the John right. Conyers and the Al Frankens paying the price while the Roy Moores and the Donald Trumps still in office? Either way, I think that we've gone through a sea change. A word we've used on your show before, that that the argument for Al Franken staying in office really disappeared, even when he was resigning, he said, well, I don't think the women remember it the way I remember it.
Exactly.
It wasn't a total apology. But I kind of think that the Democrats almost look, if they want to run against the Roy Moores and the Bill Clinton, I'm sorry, the Roy Moores and the Donald Trumps of the Republican Party, They couldn't do it really with Al Franken in office.
The political junkie with us for our first chat about politics of 2018, 651-227-6000, to talk to him about some of the changes in Minnesota politics happening today or anything. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. So as you know, Ken, Tina Smith is going to be sworn in, Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith sworn in for the rest of Franken's term. And then she is saying that she's going to run in 2018.
Right. Actually, It's not for the rest of her term. It's until the special election.
I'm sorry,
this
you're
November.
Right. You're right. Thank you. Does she start with any kind of an advantage of having held the seat for a year, given the number of Republicans and some Democrats who have eyed that seat?
Well, she does. I mean, of course, the fact that you'd rather be an incumbent in office, have a year, almost a year's experience in office when you're running for another term. But of course, you know, you're a non-elected incumbent, and I think that she's certainly not on the same par as Amy Klobuchar, who's also up for re-election this year and a heavily favored to do so. I mean, she doesn't have the stature, the statewide stature. She was almost basically an aide, a behind-the-scenes aide, her whole political life, who joined the Dayton ticket in, I guess, you know, 2014. So, I mean, she has a ways to go, and I think the Republicans are smelling blood, but we'll see what happens. I mean, we've seen other times when people have appointed themselves or been appointed to the Senate, as we saw with Luther Strange in Alabama,
right,
as we saw with Wendy Anderson in Minnesota in 1978, which was only a few weeks ago, right?
You know your Minnesota massacre,
well,
Minnesota
yeah,
state
I mean,
history.
The Minnesota
don't you?
Massacre, the Republicans called that, right?
Exactly.
So, I mean, being appointed to the Senate is not nearly as fulfilling and protective as being elected to it.
I'd like to know some other key Senate seats that you're going to be watching very closely in 2018. What are you looking at? I see there's news this morning about Orrin Hatch of Utah. Where are you zeroed in here, Ken, to see what happens?
Well, if you have news about Orrin Hatch, I have not seen it. I know there's pressure on him not to run again from many of the never-Trump Republicans. Mitt Romney would love to run for the seat, but of course I don't think he would challenge Hatch in a primary unless something happened that I didn't know about.
No, Hatch,
but, I mean, Hatch has been
Hatch is saying he's going to make a decision fairly soon and acknowledges that there is pressure building and that Mitt Romney would like to run, basically, as it's been.
Well, yes, and Donald Trump does not like Mitt Romney, and as we heard after the tax bill, when Orrin Hatch came out and said that that Donald Trump is the greatest president in history or something to that effect, clearly the president would want Hatch to run again. He's been in the Senate since 1977, the longest Republican senator in history. But, you know, sometimes, I mean, old blood is sometimes better than new blood, especially if you're a Republican and fearing what Mitt Romney might bring. There are at least two Republican seats that are in clear jeopardy. Jeff Flake is giving up the seat. It's interesting, the two biggest Trump critics in the Senate, Jeff Flake of Arizona and Bob Corker of Tennessee. Well, maybe one of the reasons they're such critics is that they're not running for re-election. Once they became Trump critics, the Republicans were out for blood for them, and basically they became very unpopular. Arizona is something to watch for the Republicans. So is Nevada, where Dean Heller is likely to be challenged by a Steve Bannon acolyte, so we'll see what happens there. But and the numbers definitely favor the Republicans. There are 26 Democratic seats up, including the Al Franken seat, 26 seats to 8 Republican seats. But of those 26 Democratic seats, 10 of them are in states won by Donald Trump. So you look at the Joe Donnellys in Indiana, the Joe Manchins in West Virginia, the Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, the John Testers of Montana. There are Democrats who may be theoretically vulnerable to a challenge, but again, Trump's numbers are down in many of these states. Even in Alabama, where his numbers were still good, the Democrats won the seat.
You know, Ken, you've kind of anticipated my next question, which is when we look at the president's disapproval, the unfavorable rating being up right now above 55%.
For a first-term president.
I wonder how you connect that then as you assess some of these particular Senate seats. I mean, how, given who Trump is and how he operates, is there a connection to look at people who disapprove and then chances for, you know, Republican candidates in some of these states, given the unique politics in some of these states?
We always know that the first midterm election following the election of a new president, it's always basically a referendum on the president. And given the fact that the president's numbers are so low, and not just in New York, New Jersey, and California, and Democratic strongholds, but in many Republican states as well, like Iowa, like Ohio, like Michigan, like Wisconsin, states where Trump won, Republicans are nervous. And so the Republicans, with Doug Jones' victory in Alabama, the Democrats only need two Senate seats, a net of two, to take control of the Senate. And they only need 24 in the House, which sounds like a lot. But if there's a tidal wave, a wave election, it's certainly doable.
The other thing I'm curious about is because we're going to start doing shows and having discussions about the agenda now of the Republican leadership for 2018 and beyond. And of course, you know, they're talking about entitlement reform. Is there also a connection between a high disapproval rating for Trump, and we know that there's high disapproval of Congress, between what they actually aim to get done and then what they can get done? How does that connect?
Well, the advantage the Republicans have now is the filibuster is basically thrown out the window. And therefore, in the past, when the minority party can hold up like a cabinet nomination or a federal appeals court nomination, they can't do it now. Part of it is the Democrats' fault. Part of it is what Harry Reid pushed through several years ago, and the Republicans took advantage of it. But having said that, given the fact that the president can, you know, unless the Republicans revolt, and they haven't done it yet, the Republicans are basically getting what they want when it comes to nominations. They really, behind the scenes, behind closed doors, it almost seems, Republicans are reshaping the federal judiciary in a major way. But the fact is, even as unpopular as Trump is, all the Republicans stayed with him on the tax increases.
Yeah,
the people
right.
who were thought to be, you know, the tax plan, I should say, the middle class tax plan, the Susan Collinses, the John McCains of the world, all of them, a lot of people thought that they may stand up and say, look, we are deficit hawks. This is not the way to be running the government, but they all stuck with him. Until Trump's numbers are so low that Republicans are going to start to say, wait a second, this could jeopardize my own reelection. I see no change as of yet, as of now, and it's only January 2nd.
And the other thing you don't see a change in, really, is that high disapproval rating softening the president's demeanor or the way he behaves on Twitter. I mean, he doesn't really seem to be affected by a high disapproval rate. Maybe he doesn't believe the poll.
Well, he doesn't believe polls in general. I always thought it was funny that every time the president would come up and say something, he would always blame the polls and blame the fake news for you know, doing things. But even when his numbers are really bad, it shows that he's not willing to change his behavior. You know, when the media used to talk about how presidential he was becoming, well, nobody's saying that anymore. And when John Kelly became chief of staff, they said, okay, he's going to rein in some of the outlandish behavior. That has not happened either. So he has no compunction, no hesitation in attacking the intelligence agencies, the FBI, his fellow Republicans. And again, until Republicans stand up and say enough is enough, or until Robert Mueller shows some kind of success in what he's going for, the Republicans are going to stay silent.
Ken, good chat. Talk to you next Monday, and have a good week.
Thank you, Carrie. Happy New Year.
Ken Rudin, the political junkie, with us for our first chat of 2018 about politics. Many more to come.